Hi, this is Mrs. English, and I'll be reading today from Richmond Lattimore's translation of Homer's Iliad. Let's begin with Book 2. Now the rest of the gods and men who were lords of chariots slept night long, but the ease of sleep came not upon Zeus, who was pondering in his heart how he might bring honor, Time, to Achilles, and destroy many beside the ships of the Achaeans, the Greeks. Now, to his mind, this thing appeared to be the best counsel, to send evil dream to Atreus's son, Agamemnon. He cried out to the dream and addressed him in winged words, "Go forth, evil dream, beside the swift ships of the Achaeans, the Greeks. Make your way to the shelter of Atreus's son, Agamemnon." Line 10. "Speak to him in words exactly as I command you. Bid him arm the flowing-haired Achaeans for battle in all haste, since now he might take the wide-wayed city of the Trojans. For no longer are the gods who live on Olympus arguing the matter, since Hera forced them all over by her supplication, and evils are in store for the Trojans." So he spoke, and Dream listened to his word and descended. Lightly he came down beside the swift ships of the Achaeans, and came to Agamemnon, the son of Atreus. He found him sleeping within his shelter, in a cloud of immortal slumber. Line 20. Dream stood then beside his head, in the likeness of Nestor, Neleus's son, whom Agamemnon honored, this is Time, beyond all elders beside. In Nestor's likeness the divine Dream spoke to him. "Son of Atreus, wise Atreus, breaker of horses, are you sleeping? He should not sleep long night long, who is a man burdened with counsels and responsibility for a people and cares so numerous. Listen quickly to what I say, since I am a messenger of Zeus, who far away cares much for you and is pitiful. Zeus bids you arm the flowing-haired Achaeans for battle in all haste, since now you might take the wide-wayed city of the Trojans, for no longer are the gods who live on Olympus arguing the matter, since Hera forced them all over by her supplication, and evils are in store for the Trojans from Zeus. Keep this thought in your heart, then. Let not forgetfulness take you after you are released from the kindly sweet slumber." Line 34. And so evil Dream has come to Agamemnon in the form of a dream, as though it is wise old Nestor speaking to him in Nestor's form, and says, "Go attack now." And this is Zeus tricking Agamemnon in a dream to believe that the Greeks can win Troy if they attack now. Now Agamemnon will wake up. Line 35. So he spoke and went away, and left Agamemnon there, believing things in his heart that were not to be accomplished. He's been tricked. For he thought that on that very day he would take Priam's city. Fool, who knew nothing of all the things Zeus planned to accomplish. Zeus, who yet was minded to visit tears and sufferings on Trojans and Danaans alike in the strong encounters. Agamemnon awoke from sleep, the divine voice drifting around him. He sat upright and put on his tunic, beautiful, fresh woven, and threw the great mantle over it. It's like a big coat. Underneath his shining feet, he bound the fair sandals, and across his shoulders slung the sword with the nails of silver, and took up the scepter of his fathers, immortal forever. This is the scepter. It would be a sort of a staff to wave around and show that he has power. Thus he went beside the ships of the bronze-armored Achaeans. Now the goddess Dawn drew close to tall Olympus with her message of light to Zeus and the other immortals. This means that the sun came up. Line 50. But Agamemnon commanded his clear-voiced heralds to summon by proclamation to assembly the flowing-haired Achaeans, and the heralds made their cry, and the men were assembled swiftly. First, he held a council session of the high-hearted princes beside the ship of Nestor, the king of the race of Pylos. Summoning these, he compacted before them his close council. "Hear me, friends. In my sleep, a dream divine came to me through the immortal night, and in appearance and stature, it figure, it most closely resembled splendid Nestor. It came and stood above my head and spoke a word to me. Line 60. Son of wise Atreus, breaker of horses, are you sleeping? He should not sleep night long who is a man burdened with counsels and responsibility for a people and cares so numerous. Now listen quickly to what I say, since I'm a messenger from Zeus, who far away cares much for you and is pitiful. Line 6-5. Zeus bids you arm the flowing-haired Achaeans for battle in all haste, since now you might take the wide-waved city of the Trojans, for no longer are the gods who live in Olympus arguing the matter, since Hera has forced them all over by her supplication, and evils are in store for the Trojans by Zeus's will. Line 70. Keep this within your heart. So speaking, the dream went away on wings, and sweet sleep released me. This is Agamemnon speaking to all of his counselors, telling them about the dream he just had. Come then, let us see if we can arm the sons of the Achaeans. Yet first, since it is the right way, I will make trial of them. I'm going to test them by words, and tell them even to flee in their benched vessels. Line 7-5. Do you take stations here and there to check them with orders? He spoke thus, and sat down again, and among them rose up Nestor, he who ruled as a king in sandy Pylos. He, in kind intention toward all, stood forth and addressed them. Friends, who are leaders of the Argives and keep their counsel, had it been any other Achaean who told of this dream, we should have called it a lie, and we might rather have turned from it. Now he who claims to be the best of the Achaeans has seen it. Come then, let us see if we can arm the sons of the Achaeans. So he spoke, and led the way, departing from the council. Line 85. And the rest rose to their feet, the sceptered kings obeying the shepherd of the people, and the army thronged behind them. And now we come to an extended simile. How did the army throng behind them? Like the swarms of clustering bees that issue forever in fresh bursts from the hollow in the stone, and hang like bunched grapes as they hover beneath flowers in springtime, fluttering in swarms together this way and that way? That's what it was like. So the many nations of men from the ships and the shelters along the front of the deep sea beach marched in order by companies to the assembly, and rumor walked blazing among them. It's line 93. Rumor here is personified. Rumor walked blazing among them, Zeus's messenger to hasten them along. Thus they were assembled, line 95, and the place of their assembly was shaken, and the earth groaned as the people took their positions, and there was tumult. Nine heralds shouting set about putting them in order to make them cease their clamor and listen to the king's beloved of Zeus. So they're getting the people in order. The people took their seats in sober fashion and were marshaled into their places and gave over their clamoring. Line 100. Powerful Agamemnon stood up, holding the scepter Hephaestus had wrought him carefully. And now we're going to get the pedigree of this scepter. Who made it? Who did it belong to? We're told here in line 101 that he's holding the scepter Hephaestus had made. Hephaestus gave it to Zeus, the king, the son of Cronos, and Zeus in turn gave it to the courier Argiophontes, that's Hermes. And Lord Hermes gave it to Pelops, the driver of the horses. And Pelops again gave it to Atreus, the shepherd of the people. Atreus, dying, left it to Thyestes of the rich flocks, and Thyestes left it in turn to Agamemnon to carry and to be lord of many islands and over all Argus. Leaning upon this scepter, he spoke and addressed the Argives. Line 110. Fighting men and friends, O Danaans, henchmen of Ares, the war god, Zeus, son of Cronos, has caught me fast in bitter futility. And the Greek word here for futility is ate, madness or delusion. He is hard, who before this time promised me and consented that I might sack strong-walled Ilion, Troy, and sail homeward. Now he has devised a vile deception and bids me go back to Argos in dishonor. This is Atime. Having lost many of my people, and remember what Agamemnon said he would do in line 73. He said he's going to test them. He's preparing his test. So in line 15 he says, Zeus bids me go back to to Argos in dishonor, having lost many of my people. And in the dream, remember that the dream told him to go and conquer Troy right now, not to go back. So he's testing the people. Such is the way it will be pleasing to Zeus, who is too strong, who before now has broken the crests of many cities and will break them again, since his power is beyond all others. Now, Agamemnon hopes that in line 115, when he says Zeus told him to go back to Argos, to Greece, in dishonor, that all of the men assembled will be horrified at the prospect of going back to Greece dishonored. Line 119. And this shall be a thing of shame. You have only to look up shame in your glossary to see how horrible this is, to go back to Argos in dishonor and shame. And this shall be a thing of shame for the men hereafter to be told that so strong, so great a host of Achaeans, Greeks, carried on and fought in vain a war that was useless against men fewer than they. So there are fewer Trojans than Greeks, with no accomplishment shown for it, since if both sides were to be willing, Achaeans and Trojans, to cut faithful oaths of truce, and both to be numbered, and the Trojans were to be counted by those with homes in the city, while we were to be allotted in tens, we Achaeans, and each one of our tens, chose a man of Troy to pour wine for it, still there would be many tens left without a wine steward. The picture Agamemnon is painting is that they significantly outnumber the Trojans. By so much I claim we, the sons of the Achaeans, outnumber the Trojans, those who live in the city, but there are companions from other cities in their numbers, wielders of the spear, to help them, who drive me hard back again and will not allow me, despite my will, to sack the well-founded stronghold of Ilion. And now 9 years of mighty Zeus have gone by, and the timbers of our ships, in line 135, have rotted away, and the cables are broken, and far away our own wives and our young children are sitting within our walls and wait for us, our halls, and wait for us, while still our work here stays forever unfinished as it is, for whose sake we came hither. We came here for the sake of our children and wives. It has been 9 years, and we have accomplished nothing. Come then, do as I say. Let us all be won over. Let us run away with our ships to the beloved land of our fathers, that's Greece, since no longer now shall we capture Troy of the wide ways. This is the end of Agamemnon's foolish testing of his men. He says, let's just go home. Even though we outnumber them, even though we'll go home in dishonor, even though we'll go home in shame, let's go home anyway. He hopes to shame his troops into saying, no, stay, stay. Although the reaction, line 142, is a shock. So he spoke, and stirred up the passion in the breast of all those who were within that multitude and listened to his counsel. And the assembly was shaken, as on the sea, the big waves in the main by Icaria, when south and southeast winds driving down from the clouds of Zeus, the father, whipped them. This, the big waves in the main by Icaria, this is named after Icarus, the son of Daedalus. These Greeks have swaying feelings, in other words. Line 147. As when the west wind moves across the grain deep standing. All right, what was it like when Zeus tested his men? This is what it was like. As when the west wind moves across the grain deep standing boisterously and shakes and sweeps it till the tassels lean, so all of that assembly was shaken. And the men in tumult swept, line 150, to the ships, and underneath their feet the dust lifted and rose high. And the men were all shouting to one another to lay hold on the ships and drag them down to the bright sea. They cleaned out the keel channels, and their cries hit skyward as they made for home and snatched the props from under their vessels. Line 155. So Agamemnon's test was disastrous, because the men simply took off for their ships, looking to get back home as soon as possible. Line 155. Then for the Argives, a homecoming beyond fate, and both homecoming and fate are key themes, just as anger. They are key themes in the Iliad. Homecoming will be very significant in the Odyssey. fate is significant in any ancient pagan epic. Then for the Argives, a homecoming beyond fate might have been accomplished had not Hera spoken a word to Athena. For shame now, Atritone, this is another name for Athena, daughter of Zeus of the Aegis. As things are, the Argives will take flight homeward over the wide ridges of the sea to the land of their fathers, and thus they would leave to Priam and the Trojans Helen of Argos to glory over, for whose sake many Achaeans lost their lives in Troy, far from their own native country. But go along now along the host of the bronze-armored Achaeans. Speak to each man in words of gentleness, and draw him backward, nor let him drag down to the salt sea their oar-swept vessels. So we have just skipped to this cosmic stage. We've just skipped up to Olympus, and Hera has told Athena, get down there and tell him they can't run away now. Line 166. So she spoke, nor did the goddess gray-eyed Athena disobey her, but went in speed down to the peaks of Olympus, and lightly went in speed down the peaks of Olympus, and lightly she arrived beside the fast ships of the Achaeans. There she came on Odysseus, the equal of Zeus in council, standing still. He had laid no hand upon his black, strong, benched vessel, since disappointment touched his heart and his spirit. All right. Homer lets us know Odysseus did not run to his ship and prepare it to leave for home. He's very disappointed. Athena of the gray eyes stood beside him and spoke to him. Son of Laertes and seed of Zeus, resourceful Odysseus, will it be this way? Will you all hurl yourselves into your benched ships and take flight homeward to the beloved land of your fathers? And would you thus leave to Priam and to the Trojans Helen of Argos to glory over? This is, of course, Kleos, for whose sake many Achaeans lost their lives in Troy, far from their own native country. Go now along the host of the Achaeans. Give way no longer. Speak to each man in words of gentleness, and draw them backward. That was line 180. Nor let them drag down to the salt sea their oar-swept vessels. So she spoke, and he knew the voice of the goddess speaking, and went on the run, throwing aside his cloak, which was caught up by Eurypates, the herald of Ithaca, who followed him. Remember, Odysseus is the king of Ithaca. He came face to face with Agamemnon, the son of Atreus, and took from him the scepter of his fathers, immortal forever. All right, first we were told that Athena recognizes, Odysseus recognized Athena's voice, and now we're told that Odysseus takes the scepter from Agamemnon, and he's going to go encourage the Greeks to stay. This shows that he's a very powerful king also, that he's able to borrow this scepter to go and fix what Agamemnon has messed up. Line 186, and took from him the scepter of his fathers, immortal forever. With this he went beside the ships of the bronze-armored Achaeans. Whenever he encountered some king or man of influence, he would stand beside him, and with soft words try to restrain him. Excellency, it does not become you to be frightened like any coward. Rather hold fast, and check the rest of the people. You do not yet clearly understand the purpose of Atreides. Of course, a son of Atreus, meaning Agamemnon. And now he makes trial, all right? He's just testing you. He's just testing you. But soon we'll bear hard on the sons of the Achaeans. Did we not all hear what he was saying in council? May he not in anger do some harm to the sons of the Achaeans? For the anger of God-supported kings is a big matter, to whom honor and love are given from Zeus of the councils. When he saw some man of the people who was shouting, he would strike at him with his staff and reprove him also. Line 200. Excellency. So he's hitting him with this scepter. Excellency, sit still and listen to what others tell you. To those who are better men than you, you skulker and coward and thing of no account whatever in battle or council. Surely not all of us Achaeans can be as kings here. Lordship for many is no good thing. We can't all be bosses. Let there be one ruler, one king, to whom the son of devious devising Cronos, line 205, gives the scepter and right of judgment to watch over his people. So he went through the army, marshaling it, until once more they swept back into the assembly place from the ships and the shelters, clamorously. How did they go back into the assembly place from their ships and their shelters? clamorously, as when, from the thunderous sea, the surf beat crashes upon the great beach, and the whole sea is in tumult. Now the rest had sat down, and were orderly in their places. But one man... All right, Odysseus gets them all to come back. They're now sitting down in their places, all except one man. Line 212. Thersites of the endless speech. It's quite an epithet. Quite an epithet. Still scolded, who knew within his head many words, but disorderly, vain, and without decency, to quarrel with the princes with any word he thought might be amusing to the Argives. Line 215. So that's why he's earned this name as Thersites of the Endless Speech. Line 216. We learn more about Thersites. This was the ugliest man who came beneath Ilion. He was bandy-legged and went lame on one foot, with shoulders stooped and drawn together over his chest. And above this, his skull went up to a point, with the wool grown sparsely upon it. Beyond all others, Achilles hated him, and Odysseus. These two he was forever abusing, but now at brilliant Agamemnon he clashed the shrill noise of his abuse. And the Achaeans were furiously angry with him, their minds resentful. But he, crying the words aloud, scolded Agamemnon. Line 225. Son of Atreus, what further thing do you want or find fault with now? Your shelters are filled with bronze. There are plenty of the choicest women for you within your shelter, whom we Achaeans give to you first of all whenever we capture some stronghold. Or is it still more gold you will be wanting, that some son of the Trojans, breakers of horses, brings as ransom out of Ilion, or that I or some other Achaean capture and bring in? Is it some young woman to lie within love and keep her all to yourself apart from the others? Is it not right for you, their leader, to lead in sorrow the sons of the Achaeans? Line 235. My good fools, poor abuses, you women. Ooh, he's calling them women. You women, not men of Achaea, let us go back home in our ships and leave this man here by himself in Troy to mull his prizes of honor of Timae, that he may find out whether or not we others are helping him. And now he has dishonored, Timae, Achilles, a man much better than he is. He has taken his prize by force and keeps her. But there is no gall in Achilles' heart, and he is forgiving. Otherwise, son of Atreus, this was your last outrage. So Thersites says, if Achilles was not so forgiven, that would have been the last time you got angry because he would have killed you. So he spoke, Thersites, abusing Agamemnon, the shepherd of the people. But brilliant Odysseus swiftly came beside him, scowling, line 245, and laid a harsh word upon him. Fluent orator though you be, Thersites, your words are ill-considered. Stop, nor stand up alone against princes. Out of all those who came beneath Ilion with Atreides, I assert there is no worse man than you are. Therefore you shall not lift up your mouth to argue with princes. It's rude. Cast reproaches into their teeth, nor sustain the home-going. We do not even know clearly how these things will be accomplished, whether we, the sons of Achaeans, shall win home well or badly. Yet you sit here throwing abuse at Agamemnon, Atreus' son, the shepherd of the people, because the Danaan fighters give him much, because the Greek fighters give him a lot. He's jealous, line 256. You argue nothing but scandal, and this also will I tell you, and it will be a thing accomplished. If once more I find you playing the fool as you are now, nevermore let the head of Odysseus sit on his shoulders. Never let me be called Telemachus's father, because his son is named Telemachus, line 260. If I do not take you and strip away your personal clothing, your mantle and your tunic that covers over your nakedness, and send you thus bare and howling back to the fast ships, whipping you out of the assembly place with the strokes of indignity. That's what Odysseus threatens Thersites with. If he ever does this again, he says, I don't have a head on my shoulders. I'm not the father of Telemachus unless I strip you and beat you, sending you right back to the ships. Line 265. So he spoke and dashed the scepter against his back and shoulders, and he doubled over, and a round tear dropped from him, and a bloody whelp stood up between his shoulders under the golden scepter's stroke. And he sat down again, frightened in pain, and looking helplessly about, wiped off the teardrops. Sorry though the men were, they laughed over him happily, 9 to 70, and thus they would speak to each other, each looking at the man next him. Come now! Odysseus has done excellent things by thousands, bringing forward good counsels and ordering armed encounters. But now this is far the best thing he ever has accomplished among the Argives, to keep this thrower of words, this braggart, out of assembly. Never again will his proud heart stir him up to wrangle with the princes in words of revilement. So the multitude spoke, but Odysseus, sacker of cities, stood up holding the staff, and beside him gray-eyed Athena, in the likeness of a herald, enjoined the people to silence, line 280. So Athena stands right beside her favorite, Odysseus, and to the people she looks like a herald, line 281, that at once, enjoined the people to silence, that at once the foremost and the utmost sons of the Achaeans might listen to him speaking and deliberate his counsel. He, in kind intention toward all, stood forth and addressed them. Son of Atreus, now, my lord, the Achaeans are trying to make you into a thing of approach in the sight of all mortal men, and not fulfilling the promise they undertook once as they set forth to come here from horse pasturing Argos, to go home only after you had sacked strong-walled Ilion. Now we are told of the promise they made before they left. They promised not to go home until they had sacked the city. For as if they were young children or widowed women, they cry out and complain to each other about going homeward, line 290. In truth, it is a hard thing to be grieved with desire for going. Any man who stays away 1 month from his own wife with his intricate ship is impatient. One whom the storm winds of winter and the sea rising keep back. And for us now, this is the 9th of the circling years that we wait here, line 295. Therefore I cannot find fault with the Achaeans for their impatience beside the curved ships, yet always it is disgraceful to wait long and at the end go home empty-handed. So Odysseus, ever the diplomat, is allowing the Greeks a little bit of consideration, saying, of course, they're anxious to go home. However, it would be very disgraceful to go home empty-handed. Line 299. No, but be patient, friends, and stay yet a little longer, until we know whether Calchas's prophecy is true or is not true. As I remember this thing well in my heart, and you all are witness, whom the spirits of death have not carried away from us, you're all witnesses except those of you who've died, yesterday and before, at Aulis, when the ships of the Achaeans were gathered, bringing disaster to the Trojans and Priam, and we beside a spring and upon the sacred altars were accomplishing complete hecatombs to the immortals under a fair plane tree whence ran the shining of water. These lines, line 303 to 307, tell us that very clearly Homer does not know about Iphigenia. Supposedly, at Aulis, when the 1,000 ships were ready to sail, there was no wind. Calchas prophesied that there was no wind because Agamemnon had offended Artemis, and Artemis in return was demanding the sacrifice of Agamemnon's firstborn daughter, Iphigenia. And here, Homer tells us that all they did at Aulis was accomplishing complete hecatombs. They were making huge offerings. Line 308. There appeared a great sign, a snake, his back blood-mottled, a thing of horror, cast into the light by the very Olympian, wound its way from under the altar and made toward the plane tree. This is Odysseus describing what happened at Aulis when they made their hecatombs. Thereupon were innocent children, the young of the sparrow, cowering underneath the leaves at the uttermost branch tip, 8 of them, and the mother was the 9th who bore these children. The snake ate them all after their pitiful screaming, and the mother, crying aloud for her young ones, fluttered about him, and as she shrilled, he caught her by the wing and coiled around her. After he had eaten the sparrow herself with her children, the god who had shown the snake forth made him a monument, striking him stone, the son of devious devising Cronus, and we were standing about, marveled at the thing that had been done. So as the terror and the god's monsters came into the hecatomb, Calchas straightway spoke before us, interpreting the god's will. "Why are you turned voiceless, you flowing-haired Achaeans?" Which literally is, "you long-haired Achaeans, you long-haired Greeks. Zeus of the councils has shown us this great portent, a thing late, late to be accomplished, whose glory shall perish never. As this snake has eaten the sparrow herself with her children, 8 of them, and the mother was the 9th who bore them, so for years as many as this shall we fight in this place. And in the 10th year we shall take the city of the wide ways." So this is Calchas' prophecy at Aulis, that they would win the war in the 10th year. Line 330. "So he spoke to us then. Now all this is being accomplished." So this is being told to them, of course, to help them to realize they will not be here another 9 years, that their victory is almost upon them. "Come then, you strong, grieved Achaeans. Let every man stay here until we've taken the great citadel of Priam." So he spoke, and the Argives shouted aloud, and about them the ships echoed terribly to the roaring Achaeans as they carried out applause to the word of godlike Odysseus. Line 335. "Now among them spoke the Gerenian horseman Nestor. 'Oh, for shame! You are like children when you hold assembly, infant children, to whom the works of war mean nothing. Where then shall our covenants go, and the oaths we have taken?'" Because covenants and oaths are a very big deal and taken very seriously, 1200 BC. "Let counsels and the meditations of men be given to the flames then with the unmixed poured wine and the right hands we trusted. We do our fighting with words only and can discover no remedy, though we have stayed here a long time. Son of Atreus," Agamemnon, "do you still as before hold fast to your counsel unshaken and be the leader of the Argives through the strong encounters?" Line 345. "Let them go perish, these one or two who think apart from the rest of the Achaeans." Okay? Let those go who think differently than the rest of us, "since there will be no use in them until they get back again to Argos, Greece, without ever learning whether Zeus of the Aegis promises false or truly." Line 350. "For I say to you, the son of all-powerful Cronos promised, on that day when we went in our fast-running vessels, we of Argos, carrying blood and death to the Trojans, he flashed lightning on our right, showing signs of favor. Therefore let no man be urgent to take the way homeward until after he's lain in bed with the wife of a Trojan to avenge Helen's longing to escape and her lamentations." Now, Calchas is projecting the idea that Helen was carried off against her will. This is very important from the Greek perspective, that Helen was carried off, stolen against her will. And that's why they're intending to pay back the Trojans in the same manner. Line 357. "But if any man is terribly desirous to go home, let him only lay his hands on his well-benched black ship, that before all others he may win death and destruction. Come, my lord, yourself be careful and listen to another." Line 360. "This shall not be a word to be cast away that I tell you. Set your men in order by tribes, by clans, Agamemnon, and let clan go in support of clan. Let tribe support tribe. If you do it this way, and the Achaeans obey you, you will see which of your leaders is bad, and which of your people, and which also is brave, since they will fight in divisions, and might learn also whether by magic you fail to take this city, or by men's cowardice and ignorance of warfare." Then in answer again spoke powerful Agamemnon, and of course we come to another speech. Line 370. "Once again, old sir, you surpass the sons of the Achaeans in debate. O Father Zeus, Athena, Apollo, would that among the Achaeans I had 10 such counselors. Then perhaps the city of Lord Priam would be bent underneath our hands, captured in sacks. But instead, Zeus of the Aegis, son of Cronus, has given me bitterness, who drives me into unprofitable abuse and quarrels." Here we listen to Agamemnon blaming Zeus for his problems, blaming Zeus for his bitterness, blaming Zeus for driving him to quarrel. Line 377. "For I and Achilles fought together for a girl's sake in words violent encounter, And I was the first to be angry. If ever we can take one single counsel, if only Achilles and I could ever get along, then no longer shall the Trojans' evil be set aside, not even for a small time. Now go back, take your dinner, and let us gather our warcraft. Let a man put a good edge to his spear, okay? Sharpen your spear, and his shield in order. Let each put good fodder before his swift-footed horses. Feed the horses. And each man look well over his chariot, careful of his fighting, line 385, that all day long we may be in the division of hateful Ares. So they want to be part of the division of the god of war, Ares. There will not even for a small time be any respite, not any rest, until darkness come down to separate the strength of the fighters. There will be a man's sweat on the shield strap binding the breast to the shield, hiding the man's shape, and the hand on the spear grow weary, line 390. There will be sweat on a man's horse, straining at the smoothed chariot. But any man whom I find trying, apart from the battle, to hang back by the curved ships, for him no longer will there be any means to escape the dogs and the vultures. So this is Agamemnon's speech. Those who fight valorously today are victors. Those who do not, those who are hanging back by the ships, they will not be able to escape dogs and vultures, which means they'll be killed and left out to be eaten. Line 394. So he spoke, and the Argives, the Greeks, shouted aloud as surf. How did they shout aloud? As surf crashing against a sheerness, driven by the south wind descending, some cliff out-jutting, never left alone by the waves from all the winds that blow, as they rise one place and another. That's how they shouted. They stood up scattering and made for the ships. They kindled the fires, smoke along the shelters, and took their dinner. Line 400. Each man making a sacrifice to some one of the immortal gods, in prayer to escape death and the grind of Ares. But Agamemnon, the lord of men, dedicated a fat ox 5 years old to Zeus, all-powerful son of Cronus, and summoned the nobles and the great men of all the Achaeans, the Greeks, Nestor before all others, and next the lord Idomeneus, next the two Iontes, those are the two Ajaxes, and Tydeus' son Diomedes, and sixth Odysseus, a man like Zeus himself, for counsel. Of his own accord came Menelaus of the great war cry, who knew well in his own mind the cares of his brother. They stood in a circle about the ox, and took up the scattering barley, and among them powerful Agamemnon spoke in prayer. That was line 411. Zeus, exalted and mightiest, sky-dwelling in the dark mists, midst, let not the sun go down and disappear into darkness, until I have hurled headlong the castle of Priam, blazing, and lit the castle gates with the flames' destruction, nor not till I have broken at the chest the tunic of Hector, torn with the bronze blade, and let many companions about him go down headlong into the dust, teeth gripping the ground soil. So this is his prayer with his offerings, that the sun will not go down until he kills Hector and many others. He spoke, but none of this would the son of Cronus accomplish, who accepted the victims, but piled up the unwished-for hardship. Line 420. So Zeus accepted the offerings, the victims. However, he would not accomplish this, that before the sun would set, Agamemnon would win, because, of course, Zeus tricked him. Line 421. And now when all had made prayer and flung down the scattering barley, first they drew back the victim's head, cut his throat and skinned him, and cut away the meat from the thighs and wrapped them in fat, making a double fold, and laid shreds of flesh above them. Placing these on sticks cleft and peeled, they burned them, and spitted the vitals, and held them over the flame of Hephaestus. But when they had burned the thigh pieces, and tasted the vitals, they cut all the remainder into pieces, and spitted them, and roasted all carefully, and took off the pieces. Line 430. Then, after they had finished the work, and got the feast ready, they feasted, nor was any man's hunger denied a fair portion. We see now that when they offer an animal victim, that they burn what they give to the gods, or they give them the fat. Then they take all the meat, they cut it up, and they have a feast. Line 432. But when they had put away their desire for eating and drinking, the Gerenian horseman Nestor began speaking among them. "Son of Atreus, most lordly and king of men, Agamemnon, let us talk no more of these things, nor for a long time set aside the action which the god puts into our hands now. Come then, let the heralds of the bronze-armored Achaeans make proclamation to the people and assemble them by the vessels, and let us together, as we are, go down the wide host of the Achaeans to stir more quickly the fierce war god." So the wise old Nestor tells Agamemnon, "Let's go from camp to camp of the men by the vessels and stir them up, get them ready for bloodshed and war." That was line 440. He spoke. Nor did the lord of men Agamemnon neglect him, but straightway commanded the clear-voiced heralds to summon by proclamation to battle the flowing-haired Achaeans. And the heralds made their cry, and the men were assembled swiftly. And they, the god-supported kings, about Agamemnon ran marshalling the men, and among them gray-eyed Athena, holding the dear, treasured Aegis, ageless, immortal, from whose edges float 100 all-gold tassels, each one carefully woven, and each worth 100 oxen. With this fluttering, she swept through the host of the Achaeans, urging them to go forward. She kindled the strength in each man's heart to take the battle without respite, without rest, and keep on fighting. And now battle became sweeter to them than to go back in their hollow ships to the beloved land of their fathers. So, with Agamemnon marshalling the men, encouraging them, and with Athena holding the Aegis beside him, and so it is just assumed that this very valuable, described, powerful Aegis has the power, if she goes beside a Greek king, to encourage them. And you'll find that the Aegis will either scare people to death or it will greatly encourage them, depending on the intent. Line 455. And we have another simile. As obliterating fire. This is what it was like. Agamemnon going among the men, marshalling them, encouraging them, and Athena going around with the Aegis. This is what it was like. Line 455. As obliterating fire lights up a vast forest along the crests of a mountain, and the flare shows far off, so as they marched, from the magnificent bronze the gleam went dazzling all about through the upper air to the heaven. These, all right, the first part of the simile is that's what it looked like. The bronze is glittering just like when you see a mountain on fire far off. These, as the multitudinous nations of birds winged, of geese and of cranes and of swans long-throated in the Asian meadow, besides the Caistrian waters this way and that way, make their flights in the pride of their wings, then settle in clashing swarms, and the whole meadow echoes with them. All right, when birds rise up and they're all together in swarms, so of these the multitudinous tribes from the ships and shelters poured forth to the plain of Scamandrus. So it's just like birds all rising up and then landing down in the meadow. Line 465. And the earth beneath their feet and under the feet of their horses thundered horribly. They took position in the blossoming meadow of Scamandrus, thousands of them. What was it like? As leaves and flowers appear in their season. What was it like? Like the multitudinous nations of swarming insects. Line 470. Who drive hither and thither about the stalls of the sheepfold in the season of spring when the milk splashes in the milk pails. In such numbers, the flowing-haired Achaeans stood up through the plain against the Trojans, hearts burning to break them. These, and what's it like? These, as men who are goatherds among the wide goat flocks, easily separate them in order as they take to the pasture. Okay, this is the simile. What's it like? Just like when goat herds go among their flocks and separate them in order to take them to the pasture. Line 476. Thus the leaders separated them this way and that way toward the encounter, and among them powerful Agamemnon, with eyes and head like Zeus who delights in thunder, like Ares for girth, and with the chest of Poseidon, like some fox of the herd, preeminent above the others, a bull who stands conspicuous in the huddling cattle. That's what Agamemnon is like, standing among the other men. All right? He's like Ares for girth, so he's huge. He has the chest of Poseidon. He is like the biggest of the oxen. Such was the son of Atreus as Zeus made him that day, conspicuous among men and foremost against among the fighters. Tell me now, you muses who have homes on Olympus, for you who are goddesses are there, and you know all things, line 485, and we have heard only the rumor of it and know nothing. Here Homer is again invoking the muse, as he will do occasionally, to say, you were there, you're immortal, you know all things, we've only heard the rumor of it, you make sure that we're telling it straight. Who then of those who were the chief of men and the lords of the Danaans? I could not tell over the multitude of them, nor name them, not if I had 10 tongues and 10 mouths, not if I had a voice never to be broken and a heart of bronze within me, line 490. Not unless the muses of Olympia, daughters of Zeus of the Aegis, remembered all those who came beneath Ilion. I will tell the lords of the ships and the ships' numbers. This is the catalogue of the Achaean ships, and you have a map, we pointed this out in class, that will show you where all of these people come from. And this is very important. This is no different than numbers in our Bible. This is very important that as Homer tells this story, each of his listeners, sitting and listening for hours and hours and hours, will hear their tribe, their area, or their city mentioned. Latus and Peneleus were leaders of the Boeotians, with Arcesilaus and Prothoenor and Cloinias, line 495. They who lived in Hyria and in rocky Aulis, in the hill bins of Etinus and Scoinus and Scaulis, Thesperia and Graia, and in spacious Mycalessus. They who dwelt about Harma and Elysian and Erythrae, they who held Elion and Hyle and Petion, line 500, with Ocalea and Median, the strong founded citadel, Copai and Etrusis and Thisbe of the Dovecotes, they who held Coronea and the meadows of Haliartus, they who held Plataea, and they who dwelt about Glisa, they who held the lower Thebes, the strong founded citadel, and Onchestras the sacred, the shining grove of Poseidon, they who held Arn of the great vineyards, and Media with Nysa the sacrosanct, and uttermost Amphidon. Of these there were 50 ships in all, and on board each of these 120 sons of the Boeotians, line 510. So, among this group of Boeotians, we have all the leaders, and we learn that there were 50 ships, and on board each of these ships there were 120 sons of the Boeotians. Remember, Agamemnon is the lord of men, the shepherd of the people, because he brought 100 ships. He brought the most ships. So the number of ships that you bring is very important. Continuing, line 511. But they who lived in Asclepius and Orchomenus of the Minyae, Ascalaphus led these, and Eolmenus, children of Ares, whom Astyochor bore to him in the house of Actor, Asius's son, a modest maiden. She went into the chamber with strong Ares, who was lain in bed with her secretly. With these two there were marshaled 30 hollow vessels. Scedius and Epistrophus led the men of Phocis, children of Iphitus, who was the son of great-hearted Nabalus. These held Caparissus and rocky Pytho, and Chrysa the sacrosanct, together with Daulis and Panapius, they who lived about Hyampolis and Anamoria, those who dwelt about Cephissus, the river immortal, they who held Lilia beside the wellspring of Cephissus. Following along with these were 40 black ships. And the leaders marshaling the ranks of the Phocians set them in arms on the left wing of the host beside the Boeotians. Swift Aias, son of Oileus, led the men of Locris, the lesser Aias, not great in size like Aias the son of Telamon, but far slighter. That this is the smaller Ajax, not Telamonian Ajax. He was a small man, armored in linen, yet with the throwing spear surpassed all Achaeans and Hellenes. These were the dwellers in Cynus and Opius and Calliaros, and in Bessa and Scarphe and lovely Agia, in Thronion and Tarphe, and beside the waters of Boagoras. Following along with him were 40 black ships. That was line 534. So we are given the leaders, and then we're told how many ships each is bringing. Line 535. He brought 40 black ships of the Locrians who dwell across from sacred Euboea. They who held Euboea and Abontes, whose wind was fury, Calchas and Eretria, the great vineyards of Histiaia, and seaborne Corinthus and the steep stronghold of Dion, they who held Charistus, and they who dwelt about Styra. Of these the leader was Elphinor, Scion of Ares, son of Chalcodon and lord of the great-hearted Abontes. And the running Abontes followed with him, their hair grown long at the back, spearmen furious with the outreached ash spear to rip the corslets girt about the chest of their enemies. Following along with him were 40 black ships, in line 545. But the men who held Athens, the strong-founded citadel, the deme of the great-hearted Erechtheus, whom once Athena, Zeus's daughter, tended after the grain-giving fields had borne him, and established him to be in Athens in her own rich temple. This temple would be the Erechtheion, of which the ruins still stand on the Acropolis at Athens. The Erechtheion is the building for the first king of Athens, Erechtheus, and the Erechtheion is the building with the Temple of the Maidens. You can look that up in your glossary. Line 550. There, as the circling years go by, the sons of the Athenians make propitiation with rams and bulls sacrificed. Of these men, the leader was Peteus's son, Menestheus. Never on earth before had there been a man born like him, for the arrangement in order of horses and shielded fighters. So what is the gift of Peteus's son, Menestheus? In line 552, he has the gift of arranging horses and shielded fighters in battle. Nestor alone could challenge him, since he was far older. And we do see a respect for age in the Iliad. Following along with him were 50 black ships. Out of Salamis, Aias, Ajax, this is Telamonian, Aias, brought 12 ships and placed them next to where the Athenian battalions were drawn up. They who held Argus and Tiryns of the huge walls, Hermione and Icene lying down the deep gulf, line 560, Troezen and Ioni and Epidaurus of the vineyards,